I wanted to just talk about between, I mean, Gillian and Ben, or something, Ben, you were talking about the moment of determination, the moment of spontaneity, and it seemed like you had a kind of slightly critical take on that, and then Gillian, when you ended up, that whole point about sedimentation, I found that quite interesting. It seems like where the affect thing comes out of for me is this whole kind of relational ontology thing that since I've been a geographer, which is 7 or 8 years, I've realised that everyone believes in relational ontologies, and I've yet to really come across a geographer that doesn't. And it seems that a relational ontology is at once how you see the world actually work, and it's also a political philosophy. It's because you like the idea that the world could be otherwise, and relational ontologies enable you to see a world that could be otherwise, and that links in with a political philosophy that helps you make it otherwise. And it seems to me that affect is doing a lot of work in between the kind of relational ontology and the political philosophy. It's kind of doing the linking thing. So, I mean, your point, Gillian, about sedimentation. I wonder what happens when sedimentation actually, so much of that happens, and this again could be an outcome of certain affects. So much sedimentation happens that something is actually becomes no longer available to be done otherwise. What if one of the affects is for things to become out of circulation, to be no longer available, to settle in so far that they become effectively permanent or beyond being influenced or beyond being available to be done otherwise. So it's just there's a kind of a tension there that I'm wondering if you could kind of, either of you, any of you could come back to.
Yeah, the first point about the relationship between affect and relationality, or affect and some kind of claims to a relational ontology, I'd perhaps read it a little differently. I think affect has, on my reading, been one of a whole series of terms which are precisely about how to make sure a relational ontology isn't simply a monism in which nothing actually ever happens because everything is already always connected. So affect, as I read it, has been, if you like, it's been the excess to a series of relations only relating together. It's been that moment of indetermination within a relational ontology. So it's perform, and this is why, which we haven't talked about today, the link between affect and Deleuze's concept of the virtual becomes so important to making that move, so important to that kind of wager that actually, because the virtual is only ever actualised in that process of actualisation as a movement of differentiation. An affect is, if you like, the name for that movement of differentiation. That it's precisely as a kind of disruption of a relational ontology that the term affect has been so important to securing this idea that everyday life is, everydayness is synonymous with the potentiality for things to become otherwise. One of the things I was really interested in a few years back was boredom. Boredom precisely, and the challenge of how do you think boredom, if you presume this moment of differentiation is primary, because boredom is precisely about, on my reading, a suspension of possibility when the world doesn't offer you anything. So I became interested in boredom precisely as a critique of the relation between affect and change in some ways. So I'd maybe make a different comment there about the link between relational ontology and affect. See affect doing a different kind of work there, doing the same kind of work as, in many ways, same kind of work as difference, same kind of work as excess, same kind of work as force in ANT, all about an operator that differentiates somehow. And I completely agree with your point that this becomes really problematic, and it's the point other people have made, including people in the room, that when this is used to secure a set of political or kind of ethical practices, or at least to secure a kind of guarantee that, if you like, resistance precedes power, any of these kind of slogans, then it becomes problematic. But I'd probably say that on the first point, the relationality point.
Yeah, that's because I wasn't going to say anything about that. So, when you were talking about things being sedimented so that they become no longer available to, I think that's a very nice way to put it, that they can't be done otherwise anymore. I think that's right. I think that was kind of what I was trying to get at. I think, though, what that might entail, particularly for thinking about subjects that can't do things otherwise, or that partner. I think we need to be careful about what kind of subjectivity we're then talking about. I'm thinking that there's a recent paper by Paul Routledge trying to put human agency back into actor network theory. And I think the way he does it is actually with a very unproblematized notion of what human agency is. And I would say Steve's work drawing on psychoanalysis or various versions of that, I think actually provide a much more complex way of thinking about what that sort of durability or sedimentation might actually be, which itself could be quite unpredictable and different in different circumstances and so on.
I'm not a geographer and my voices have gone, so I'll try to formulate two questions. I see how far I go. They're both addressed to Dan. Thank you for the paper, Dan. It was a fascinating presentation. My first question is about the two concepts of security that you've used, because I had the feeling that actually the paper spoke to the first, which to me is the kind of Hobbesian concept of security, kind of talks about the dangerous supplement and the promise. And I was wondering, if you were to talk to the second concept, which is basically about the imbrication of security and insecurity, and security as a technology of governing societies and population and order in the polis, I think perhaps, I wonder what the status of these exercises would be, because at the moment I think you define exercises as security one rather than security two. And that was the question, what do they mean politically? And then affect comes in, because I think affect had a third element in which it wasn't just a technology used to invest in subjects, but it was also a moment of potentiality. And I was wondering, where does this potentiality come in? I mean, I guess that's what you said now. So as a moment of transformation, or is there potentiality for transformation within what you are describing? And I think the third point is about continuity and discontinuity. What is the difference the present brings? Is there something different about post 9/11 and the imagination of the future, given the way you look back at civil defense and the president? That's all I can go. Thank you.
Yeah, they're obviously great questions. I'll probably take them actually in reverse order. The question of continuity and discontinuity. How to answer this? I think the first thing I'd say, I think what we do have is a discontinuity in style of relating to the future, a break with probabilistic prediction, where the future is predicted on the basis of the past dispersion of events, and we have a break to a different style of relating to the future, what Richard Grushin and others, Louise, etc., and others have called or are calling pre-mediation, where how pre-mediation functions and how exercises one technique of pre-mediation functions is precisely, first of all, by saying the future will be a surprise, and that you can never settle on your account of the future. The aim is not to get the future right through techniques like this. The aim is just to continually multiply possibilities that could happen. So I'd say there is a discontinuity between, if you like, style of relating to the future from possibilistic prediction to this thing called premediation. I think the idea of the future as a surprise, the idea of the future as not only, we don't only lack knowledge of the future, if we had kind of like an incredibly large computer, we could know the future. But that the future is kind of by definition indeterminate. I think that notion of the future has a much more complicated genealogy to it. That one of the things I want to do in future work is trace or begin to trace that genealogy. You'd need to trace it back to a long tradition of thinking about surprise in military thinking, for example. You need to trace it to in some ways, everyday practices of daydreaming and how they relate to this idea of future, idea of the future. So. Discontinuity in one way, continuity, or potential continuity at a different point. But then what I didn't talk about is these exercises are basically ways of making futures present, but they always fold into different kinds of anticipatory logics, different ways of acting in the present on the basis of those futures which have been made present. So preemption, preparedness, precaution, like as your work has described these things. And then they all have complicated genealogies as well, where it's less a kind of categorical break between, kind of, and more this a constant redeployment of elements which were used to govern futures in certain ways. In other words, so my question is that what we have is, my answer is, we have a differentiated set of phenomena here, certain continuities, certain discontinuities. I don't know what you make of that answer. Anyway. Okay, the second to last point, I'll speed up because I'm hugging discussion on that, which is basically about kind of, about as I hear it, kind of freedom as the correlative of technologies of security, and how affect folds into or doesn't fold into a kind of fleeing, a kind of exit or exodus within the context of these kind of exercises. I might have heard that completely wrong. I might need to rephrase the question. I mean, there's two ways of answering this. One of which is that what's kind of interesting is the political contestation which is emerging around exercises, which is primarily in the sphere of conspiracy theory, where you have the fact that exercises occurred kind of like the day before the 7/7 bombings, an exercise into the planes crashing into the Pentagon had been done kind of like the previous year, 9/11, et cetera, et cetera. Is used, that kind of exercises become political through that work of conspiracy. But there's also kind of like a whole, what we want to do with ethnographies, there's a whole lot more going on within the actual site of exercise, and I've even had a moment to talk about. There's a great report on an American exercise where basically the problem of that exercise was that actors who had been paid to participate in it became bored, and the exercise was it was basically an exercise into terrorists shooting down an aeroplane over a beach, and what the actors started to do was just make sandcastles. And so the exercise had to be stopped because people weren't pretending to be dead, they were building sandcastles. Now, which would just hard to have done my ethnography when that happened. That would be wonderful. So I think there's all those moments of kind of, if you like, the kind of like the expression and qualification of different emotions and feelings, which add a certain kind of indeterminacy to the exercise itself. So the question is, how does an exercise hold together, cohere enough within all these differences to still function as a technique for governing futures? And your first point, I actually understood what I was doing as actually being more about the second point, which shows how kind of like my, how badly I communicated it, I think. Because precisely what you're precisely right about the Hobbesian thing going on with the first distinction there, but precisely what I was doing with the second one is with that second notion of securing, and saying a little bit more about securing than kind of it's just processual, saying that exercises function because they always fail. Exercises function because what they disclose is that we are not prepared enough. What exercise, or if you look at after action reports for exercises, which are produced after all exercises, there's always, like, even if the exercise has been incredibly successful, there's always some difference between what present capabilities you have and what that exercise will do, what that event will do when it disorders. So exercises, this is why I said exercises function in a kind of a strange kind of way. On the one hand, they manage bad surprises. They make sure there can never be anything as a genuine surprise, but they introduce a minimum difference, which is precisely that process of securing, and precisely what propels that process of securing and insecuring at the same time. But is that kind of what you meant about the second, that first and second distinction, or not really?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, let's talk about it later. Yeah.
I think it's incredibly obvious in some ways, but at least the virtue of being and it's kind of about... It's obvious because it's a sort of classic sort of hang-up, but it's something to do with the difference between what people say, and particularly about what people say about what they do and what they do. And I was kind of interested in how that kind of came up in different ways in all three of the things. And I was kind of interested in what that said about those different settings in some ways, but also maybe about what it means or why. Look at facts and some of the other things people discuss. So, in Ben's example, one of the things about doing exercises is you're right, I mean, as you just said, it's about, you know, what's new comes up. But it's also, presumably, partly about people. So, people have all these kind of procedures written down, what we'll do in emergency, but we know that people don't do that. So, the people won't do what they say they'll do, and the plans won't work in the way, you know, and so on. So it's a kind of, there's a necessity it's almost starting from the my less point, I suppose it's starting from the assumption that it succeeded, and so then you have to do the exercises, and that's, and it's actually a kind of mode of getting at that, what people do. In Steve's, there was there's something about demonstration, that kind of the thing, the fact that the woman was in the room and being kind of problem poked. It wasn't just a discussion of her or another case. There was it's that kind of moment of psych between science and social science and arts and so on. So there's something kind of interesting about, even though Chambaud maybe doesn't say very much, or Gordon doesn't say very much, there's something about the kind of something about that going on there. And then Gillian says the kind of classic thing about how do you get at people, particularly in a kind of interview sort of situation, how do you get at people's stuff in the background, basically all the kind of stuff that's non-rep in that sort of kind of psychological sense of kind of keeping on going things. And then you talk about different techniques of getting at that, like passing about colour nice and things like that. But there's the exercise, and that's one particular mode, and there's the kind of demonstration, that's another particular mode, and there's the social science, that's another particular mode. And that's not really a question, it's kind of a comment, and just asking people to reflect on those.
You're warmed up. I'm still wondering how I might go through that. Go on, Julia.
Go on, you've got your breath in first.
Question methodology, I suppose, in a way, because describing the effect of the more came through people talking about it. Now, in theory, precisely because it's non-representational effect, you can't talk about it. Although, of course, if I'd been able to write about it, that's us talking as opposed to subject, so it's a kind of, catch yourself in the corner kind of thing. So there's that, which I suppose is sensitive, a bit of a kind of dead-end discussion, because we all know that dilemma. But one thing that does, I'm still pondering around, is the important, is these benches. I've been going on about this for about a year now, but the benches are really important. And I was showing you, we've got loads of photos of people doing a lot of different things on benches. But when nobody's talked about them, they've never come up as part of the survey that we did about what people think about or notice about them all. I don't think people have ever sat down with... You've done most of the walk-alongs, thank you. I don't think I've ever sat down with you on a bench as part of... We've got kind of accompanied people as they've done shopping or browsing or errands in the mall. They've never sat down with us. So this seems to be this important thing we can see, but actually I don't know what it's like, and I can relate it to questions of mobility, because mobility produces pause, but that's a kind of, a bit of a kind of post-structural theoretical leap rather than a grounded, sort of ethnographic, descriptive claim. I think it's a real question, I suppose. But Ben, you were saying about your exercise research grant project that the referee said that the methods were non-representational enough. So back to
fantastic.
Yes,
I see wanting more non-representational theory.
Backtrack.
I'm not quite know, and I'm kind of voicing for the question about the photographs in a way, I suppose, because you might think that the images carry more than, you might also think, and whether they're an effective way to convey more than that. But I'm still, as the author of something around visual methodology, I am still puzzling around that and what might actually be possible. So that's not an answer, but other than to acknowledge that it's a really
atmosphere, the way Ben was talking about it, was a better description of what was going on than effect.
I think I might add that, actually.
To say that the whole thing had an effect, that, don't know, that doesn't, but that does quite resonate for me, but atmosphere is a different.
I mean, you kind of, this is obviously like a structural problem at the heart of exercises. Exercises are, there's stuff written about fantasy documents and kind of like, it's precisely the fantasy of securing which occurs after this, as well as the supplement insecure. But in some ways, kind of like the point you're asking is kind of like more important than the specific example of exercises, obviously. I don't necessarily see such a tension here. I see kind of, words, speech acts, utterances, etc., as folding back into the composition of atmospheres. I see the descriptive work we do here as forms of presentation that establish some form of connection, however fleeting, or not fleeting, with a series of situations. It enables something. Our writing, our presentations are technologies of circulation, if you want it, or contagion or transmission, whichever term we want to use. And this is why a certain kind of type of non-representational theory, which has always been incredibly attuned to the intricacy of language, thinking about Eric Lorien's work, would be described to me, I would describe it as a non-representational theory, precisely. But it's just pushing that work on speech, and also pushing that work on the kind of the presentation of representation. So the difficult question then becomes the question Steve has raised about, if you begin from this layer cake ontology, how do you understand the interactions between those different layers? Because one thing which was striking about, I don't know if Steve intended this, but in many ways, I read it as stating there is no theoretical conflict whatsoever between affect and emotion. The work on emotional geographies and the work in non-representation theory on affect have basically the same conception of emotion. It's just whether you attend to them or not. It's just whether you make a political and ethical decision about what you're interested in. That would be one implication. I don't know if you'd agree with that. Maybe not. You might be banging your hand on the table. I was warned earlier.
Told not to bang your hand. And I think the only person who did was Gillian.
But it's precisely why I think a notion like atmosphere is interesting. It's because it's precisely about the interrelations between all those different. It's about what Massimo terms the feedback of higher forms. It's about precisely how the feedback of qualified emotions feed back into the composition of a kind of affective background. It's how feelings can be at times qualified in emotions, at times recirculate, retransmit, recontagious again. So you could redraw your layer cake diagram with kind of like a diagram more like Freud's of kind of dotted lines like that. When you actually look how I think in people's empirical work in practice, it becomes very difficult to hold these distinctions. And actually, people's empirical work in practice is precisely about the passages and the transformations across these different layers. So there's a distinction between, if you like, a formal or modal distinction, which you start your analysis with, and how that analysis becomes operationalized in empirical work. And the danger of offering a critique of, or offering a particular account of, the literal affect and emotion is that you begin by the moment where the people offer the formal or modal distinction, rather than when that modal distinction or formal distinction breaks apart, as people actually do kind of empirical work on hope, boredom, or whatever Derek's doing at the minute. I don't know if that answered your question, Nick.
That was kind of the answer that I had.
I think it speaks to both the issue, because the same issue came up in both the other things, which is how does all the other stuff play into this, and I think, I agree with you, there's much more of a kind of a partially connected but kind of all on the surface.
I mean, if we're going to see Massuma, and you're right that Massuma is the kind of theoretical text for the working affect in geography, there's a really interesting footnote where basically he says, okay, I've established this conceptual distinction, but it always breaks down. And I've just established it, but bear in mind that it has already broken down, it is in the process of breaking down. So
it's another kind of cape of having a cape.
yeah, that would be.
I guess what I've been thinking is, one way of taking your question is, what's the relationship between the sayable and the unsayable, I guess. The other thing is to actually say, what difference does it mean to think these things in different situations, which is the other, you know, also what you're asking. In other words, can we apply the same, what happens when we're in an exercise or a demonstration or in Milton Keynes? And for me, I think that what some of those differences are about are precisely, you know, that then suddenly affect starts to become a small thing rather than a big thing, and these other things start happening. And the demonstration is precisely set up as an affectual situation, so in that sense carries similarities to the exercise. What you have within the demonstration in that situation in setting it up like that is, of course, an agreement around, an unconscious agreement around the rules that you are here to witness and to do hysteria. And that's that kind of the theatre of the whole group that's been doing, much as we are involved in a theatre of the whole group in this room. That's quite different from the exercise, for which wide varieties of people are coming together to participate in different futures, different activities. I mean, it has similarities, but they are different because your modality, the modalities of what's going on are remarkably different. I think as you scale these things differently, as you put them in different situations, I don't think you can simply apply the same conceptual, the same conceptual forms in these different situations. And that's why I think you know, when you start saying, well, what is the affect of a nation or a city? I mean, you know, I've also used the word atmosphere. What is the atmosphere of a city? And you go, you know, you can't quite use the term, and yet we all know that, I mean, we've had these kind of discussions. We all know that New York is different from London, and it has a different mood and affect and atmosphere and blah, blah. But actually kind of laying, you know, thinking about how you might understand that isn't the same as saying what's the transpersonal thing that is shared amongst people. Actually, it's something very different from that. More like these kind of heterogeneous diversities, some forms of communication through representations and science. I mean, all this stuff is kind of in play in these different kind of forms, I think. The demonstration, I think, is interesting in that it's meant to be a kind of, because it's science stripped out of all the other stuff, but of course all that stuff is kind of going on. The expectations and wishes of doctors to see the hypnotized do their hysterical thing, the wish and desire of the hypnotized, the hysteric, to perform the hysteria, to exaggerate it, to show that they are hysterical and that the symptoms they have, symptoms that don't necessarily point even to their own symptoms, but maybe to somebody else's symptoms. You know, so you've got these kind of different levels, or these kind of different forms of different forms of communication. I think that's what, you know, some of what is going on here is actually these wide varieties of forms of transmission, circulation, contagion. I mean, some of these are fine, but some of them really aren't. I think. I guess the other thing is that it is this kind of proximity problem. I mean, the ethnography that sets up. Ultimately, the interesting thing about non-representational theory is its default mode is ethnography, which is chat and proximity, and then whatever happens in those ethnographic situations then gets said. And there's something quite, what then when you haven't witnessed or done or spoken to somebody about the thing that you're describing. Is there a non-ethnographic, non-representational practice? I don't know. So there's some really interesting things about the production of sites in that way, I think.
I think it's got to fall to me to answer Milton Keynes' question. Having, sometime in the 1980s, given a vote of thanks at a presentation by the chief architect of the shopping building, I mean, what strikes me about what you found is that a lot of it was explicitly, intentionally designed in. So we had a long presentation of the whole history of the evolution of architecture, in which I guess Le Corbusier was a kind of crowning moment of functional efficiency and aesthetics brought together. It's quite clear that the spaces that you were largely talking about were designed as a circulation space, as a space whose function was precisely to get you from the car park into shops or into restaurants. Where it then is not quite designed, and where some little tensions and surprises come in, is that it was designed without doors. And initially, and of course in those days shops were open for shorter hours, initially it was a great recreational space for young parents like me, because on wet Sunday afternoons in the winter you could take your kids there and rampage up and down in this very nice 2 kilometre space. When it went from the Development Corporation to a private management company, the doors appeared very sharply. So privatisation turned it from being a sort of slight compromised public space into just a way of getting you to the shops. And then I think, for me, the second little tension around that you alluded to is those benches. And obviously, if this is a circulation space, it's not actually designed to let you or to help you to settle
and have a sandwich or have a chat or talk with your mates. It's designed to keep you moving. But actually, as you said, people are doing it but not talking about it. So here's a kind of little methodological point that they're apparently not conscious of that thing. I mean, in the original version, all the benches were marble. So, you know, you could sit on them, but you couldn't sit on them for very long before you had an urgent desire to go somewhere with a sausage.
Medical attention.
So I guess what surprises, that what, you know, what strikes me is that this is over 30 years, a pretty successful piece of design just as a circulation space, a kind of non-sedimentary circulation space. Then the new bit, the bit with the tree and the curves, was a bit of a departure from that. And it's interesting that apparently your respondents hardly perceive that. And, you know, that's a bit worrying for all of us sitting here, since the landlord of that part is the AUT, and our pensions derived from Devon's USS, sorry. So, you know, it had better be more successful than the old bit. That's,
yes.
That's all I can say. Yeah.
But, don't tell them.
Yeah. Pensions are a lie on this.
Well, that's all true. And there's actually a fantastic, very sort of heroic book about the building of the centre, which talks about the struggle to find a private investor, and lots of the architects talking about Derek Walker, the designer, and his particular aesthetic and so on. So you're right. And in that sense, it is designed for circulation. And you might argue that actually seats have to be provided because it's so long, which a lot of people comment that actually you can't just keep on walking, it's too tiring, you know, you have to sit. So if you want to keep people walking, you then also have to provide places for them to sit. Having said that, though, I mean, one of the things that I know the architects were really, really enthusiastic about was the planting. And we've got some kind of, I don't know how many of you know, well, you saw the big trip now, actually large trees in the centre. And a lot of money spent in there, you know, planting in the first place. I was surprised that not an awful lot of people commented on that planting, which for me is a really, you know, really striking part of the centre. So it is quite a selective, I think it is a selective account, even given what the architect wanted. But I think the other thing to say is that in a sense, they've almost been too successful, you might say, in getting the flow. Because what the mall seems to have had a persistent problem in is helping people find their way or work out where they are in the mall and how to get somewhere else. So it started off with each of the arcades and the cross things that have names, and all the gates into the car parks are numbered. But this just isn't enough. So maps have now gone up, like printed maps. And now, just recently, when we were there last week, what they're doing is installing touchscreen maps. So that what you do, this is a helpful tip for your Christmas shopping on the King's Mall, if you do want to do it all under one warm, bland environment, is that you go to one of these screens and you find the shop that you want, because people shop by brands in Milton Keynes. They don't do window shopping. They go to the shop they know will have the stuff that they want. So I'm sure you'd all go for Waterstones. So you go W Waterstones, and then the screen comes up and it will show you how to walk through the mall from where you are, from that screen to that shop. And we found that a lot of it is actually, because you're encouraged to move, because it does all look quite similar, people, especially people who don't visit it that often, for whom it isn't a weekly place to visit, it's monthly or less, it's quite disoriented. You, especially in the middle block, you can go in one side of the shop and come out the other, and it actually looks the same as the block you've just left. So I've done this many times, you turn the wrong way. So that flow actually is almost too good. And I think that's one reason why people get really annoyed at it, which is why the emotion kicks back against the effect, because it's, you know, you lose a lot of time faffing around trying to find these blooming maps where, you know, to work out where, you know, how to get from Woolies to Boots kind of thing. So you're right, it was designed, but I think that's quite, I mean, in terms of engineering effect, which is something I wanted to, because I think we all talked a bit about this like, notion that you can actually engineer a specific effect. A, is that possible? And B, if it is, maybe you can do it too well and actually get people annoyed, you know, or building sandcastles, or, you know, stomping off back to their car and, you know, rather than, you know, continuing with what the effect is, you know, the intention is of the effect to get them to do.
And
so
that's
about
the same thing. Let's look at the relationship with the market as the shopping centre, or was it just the building?
We have one go is kind of accompanying things. One was around the market rather than the centre, and there's a kind of traditional kind of market square place right next door to this big modernist centre. And there's a very people contrast the two places very strongly.
Yeah.
So both in terms of the material, the kind of the atmosphere that I was describing. The kind of things you can do there, even the kind of ways in which people move there, you can kind of wander around and grab and kind of cross cut and reach across in the market, whereas in the mall it's kind of up and down and you have to sort of shimmy your way through the flow. So it's very strongly contrasted.
I have a question as a non-geographer, and this is the first time I've encountered this discussion really, and it seems as though there's a kind of little problem of language here in some senses. You're trying to sort of convey what is non-representational, what is emotional, what is intuitive. It's obviously a key kind of concept here. When you're talking about things like your atmosphere or ambience and so on. And sort of try and pick it apart and subject it to kind of critical interrogation and try and analyse its various parts is very difficult. And don't we lose something in the process of doing that? Because whole point about things like emotions and intuitions, they are irrational and they're not possible to pin down in some form. Sort of, you mentioned points about the ethnographer, the non-ethnographer. It's not obviously just about chat, it is about using interpretation and intuition in a very non-specific way that people don't like to talk about because it's not part of the kind of rational academy perspective, but it is nevertheless there and a big part of any kind of ethnographer's. So I don't know, it seems rather sort of odd discussion to sort of be having to try and get valiant to try and do it, because it's one of those kind of other spheres that we don't like to talk about, but it's difficult.
I just wanted to bounce on, because there was an encouragement that maybe we should organise themselves. I think that it's not necessarily true that emotions within the academy would be always regarded as irrational. There are certain theorists who regard them as highly rational because we use them for day-to-day decision-making, and you say being a case in point. So that's just one qualification I want to throw in there, because I think that you guys are working, I'm assuming you're working on the assumption that emotions are in fact rational parts of thought processes.
I mean, I'd add a couple of qualifications to that. I think any general statement that emotions are rational or emotions are irrational ends up reproducing a kind of universalism that I'd actually want to get away from. I think what's much more interesting to me is the question of, in any given situation, how is rationality effectively imbued, and how is affect rationally imbued, and what in any given situation is rationality. So I would agree with your qualification of the terms of the question almost, even though I completely see why.
Say the precision of language.
I completely see why the question's actually a very important one. But I wouldn't necessarily see classification in the work of what we're doing as necessarily a reductive movement that somehow. Somehow you've kind of like have the kind of like the excessive, the excess of the world, and somehow kind of knowledge is a specification of that excess, and which you lose something inevitably. I think you can offer kind of responsible forms of classification, responsible ways of making distinctions, which actually if they work, can sensitise you to complexity, and that's kind of what I read us as doing. It's kind of like trying to find a way of working through what these different terms do in interaction with one another and what they can sensitise us and orientate ourselves to in the world around us. So I think my second qualification in relation to your point, because I agree with the point, but my second qualification would be classification is not necessarily always a bad thing. Classification can do kind of like generative work to resensitise you to complexity in any given situation. I think the point about engineering affect, it's kind of interesting, I think, because there's kind of several questions we need to ask here. I think, first of all, what does it mean when affect becomes an explicit object for thought, as affect is here, but when what does it mean to objectify affect as something which is to be engineered? What does it mean for people who design exercises to say we're attempting to produce a stressful atmosphere and we understand stress according to this kind of either folk psychology or really explicit psychology? And so I think the first question is, what does it mean to have a referent object of kind of knowledges and techniques? But then secondly, the more difficult question is, how is the process of engineering affect always already affected itself? how is a process of engineering stress always already bound up with the particular organisations of kind of feelings, emotions and affect that go into that very... how that process of engineering occurs. Otherwise, you end up by saying, okay, you have the engineering of this thing called affect, which is an object, a kind of separation between this object and you, and the actual process of engineering, almost, I think.
I just go back to the, you know, why bother with the terminology. Just scoot back for a moment. I think it might be a bit of a disciplinary thing, actually, a geography, because the other term that I was thinking through instead of affect was sense of place, actually, which is a very, very old, has a particular sort of heritage within geography from a sort of tradition of humanist geography, which is rather sort of touchy-feely and very, not terribly interested in kind of theoretical interrogation of. Yes, I'm giving you a sort of shorthand, but I think. So I think some of this is almost an attempt to go back, perhaps, to some of that, as you say, that kind of sense, that intuitive, that feel of place, but to do it in a more rigorous way than it has been done before within this particular discipline. So I think maybe some of the work, the conceptual work that's being done is partly, perhaps in relation to an earlier moment where the perceptions are not enough conceptual work was done to really clarify how this might work.
So
you want to comment on engineering, or are you
done? No, I'm happy with what you said. It's all very interesting. I think, the one thing is about the notion of the subject, the conception of the subject that is being evoked. I mean, your other question was, can emotional geography and affect geography, is there some concept in the middle that would somehow fit both, work for both sides? And, some of this sense of place stuff is about, it was quite rigorous in terms of its philosophy. Except that what it called upon was a set of universalisms around a coherent sense of the subject, right? My personal feeling is that your work is intended to produce some kind of conceptual middle ground, but that you can't do that unless you abandon... when you abandon affect geography in order to occupy a terrain suitable for the emotional geography, then you will have abandoned affect geography, because it is about producing about the nature of the split within the the nature of that split within the mind. Is there a split between affect and emotion? When you are speaking in emotion, what is the relationship to an affect? And it's interesting hearing you talk, of course, because you are in some middle ground in which when you are evoking affects and emotions, and you're switching between these kind of relationships. And that, of course, requires you to have a very different, form than that kind of radical split, because you need to be able to say there is some relationship between emotion and affect, which, of course, is what the emotional geographers would have, except that, of course, by siding in the speakable, have lost a sense of the kind of affects. So I think a lot of this is to do with the notion of the subject that's being invoked, and what does affect do? It is a question of what kind of people do you think are you evoking who are doing the doing in these situations.
I can't both those things be going on the same time. I think that's all Ben's point about your layer cake thing was that it wasn't so much a case of who was right or wrong, as that both things are going on the same, they're both in cake, pretty different layers. Isn't the empirical thing is about looking at and finding all that stuff going on in a moment and situation and a kind of whatever. It's not about choice. There's only effect going on or only emotion going on, there's all this thing going on, and it's how to deal with that is actually the kind of challenging.
Yeah, but this comes back to your relationship between the sayable and the unsayable, and again about that split between the reason and unreason, and how various kinds of splits take place. If you presume that there is already a split, and that doesn't have to be accounted for because that's already true, then you're doing something very different when you're saying what's the relationship between affect and emotion, as opposed to a question that says, well, how do things become emotion or become affect? In other words, saying, how do you get to the point at which affects and emotions are somehow once how does something become unspeakable? How do we get to a point in the constitution of any subject where something cannot be said? And of course, partly the psychoanalytic point is that quite a lot of work happens in advance of as you become a subject that prevents you from saying what you could otherwise say. And it's like a dream, you can recount a dream and you will sit there going, it's so bizarre, I have no idea what it would. And you tell somebody else and they go, actually, that's a stress dream. Or, it's because you can't see it because it's unsayable to you. It doesn't mean to say it is unsayable. And yet you sit there going, no, it's really weird. To other people, very boring. I think your question is right. The question is, how do these things get disentangled? How do splits get in the psyche get produced? How might these splits be undone, ruptured at different points? I think that's fine. When you start that in that question, then you're in a very different place from either emotional geography or affectual geography, each of which have incompatible ontologies of the subject. Maintain.
The word in the world is multiple, though, isn't it? There are different ontologies going on at the same time. Well, that's not very important, but that is the case. So it doesn't matter if
there is an ontology.
But that goes back to the point about then the consequences of positing these things also has political implications. So the positing the subject in the way that affectual geography does has a consequence of seeing certain kinds of things, and it doesn't see politics particularly, it sees ethics of touch, contact, and situations of increased capacities and possibilities. That's one thing, but posed in an emotional geography way, what you get is a politics of caring, more emotional, you're looking after people's happiness. Abstract term, undefined, that's what it's headed for, it's for better. So there are different things. There may be different ontologies of the subject, but that's not within either of their conceptions that would be possible. There are simply the way people are.